Miriam Horn's latest book, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, challenges many traditional notions, such as what it means to be a sustainable producer, what conservatism or conservation looks like, and the idea that socially conservative Americans are hostile to environmental issues. She profiles a series of regular people from the so-called flyover country, people who might not think of themselves as environmentalists, but who do important environmental work. It's published by W.W. Norton. Miriam Horn's previous book, Earth, the Sequel, which she co-authored with Environmental Defense Fund President Fred Krupp, was a New York Times bestseller and was also adapted into a Discovery documentary. I'm very pleased to welcome Miriam Horn to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
You have focused on food production and some of the people who are engaged in it. Worldwide, how much of the earth is dedicated to growing food?
We now have half of the ice-free earth in agriculture between cropland and pasture land, and agriculture uses 70% of our fresh water supply.
The people you've profiled come from families with deep roots in the land that they work, some of them even also on the water. Yet aren't they being forced by nature to rethink how they produce food?
Well, I don't know about being forced by nature. They are definitely revising their understanding of nature and our relationship to nature. They no longer have a view that we only succeed by clearing everything else away. They recognize that the only way they thrive is if they actually sustain the natural ecosystem that they live within.
When I said forced by nature, I was thinking climate change. Do they think in terms of climate change?
Well, they certainly recognize that the weather is changing. They think in terms of extreme weather. They take different positions about whether it's caused by human beings or not. But certainly if you look at Justin Knopp, the farmer in Kansas I profile, he's living with unbelievably erratic weather. And everything he does is not only aimed at making his land more resilient to those extremes, but also actually in helping to solve the problem by storing carbon in his soils.
What generation farmer is he?
He is fifth. His mother's family homesteaded right after the Civil War, the land he's still on.
The prairie lands, which were settled because they provided abundant yields. Is that no longer the case?
No, it was kind of a losing game. When we broke all that sod and we plowed up all that soil, we enjoyed several generations of just unbelievable productivity because we were basically burning through millions of years of accumulated fertility. But when you bust sod and you plow soil, you actually end up doing a great deal of damage to the microbial ecology and the fertility. So by the Second World War, those soils were pretty played out.
That's after the Dust Bowl developed, but the same process?
Yes. When you strip soil bare, when you take these prairie soils that had mats of roots that went 20 feet deep that were holding them, and the soil was sheltered by living and dead plants, when you turn those upside down, they're completely vulnerable to blowing away.
And you write that soil is kind of like an upside-down forest.
It is. It's the most biodiverse ecosystem on Earth, even though that goes largely unrecognized, and we understand very little about the life in the soil. We only know a few of the organisms, but it's probably the most critical ecosystem on Earth.
How does that soil infrastructure work? You write, old root systems act as roads for the good fungi to travel.
Right. So there are deep pores. If you leave soil undisturbed and sheltered, it has a texture that's like a chocolate cake or a coral reef. There's a tremendous amount of space in it that allows water and air to percolate all the way in. If you keep those microbes alive, if you keep your fungi alive, they have these long silvery webs that hold the soil together, and they actually ferry nutrients to the plants. It's this huge community working together. They bring nutrients to the plants. They protect the plants from disease.
And the soil stores carbon?
The soil stores a lot of carbon. Before that sod was broken, it was about 5% carbon. It, by the Second World War, was played down to about zero, but the way that these farmers are farming now is building that carbon back up.
You say that Justin is an advocate of no-till farming. So tilling the soil, which seems to be the way we've always done farming, is really bad because it frees the carbon?
It's bad in a number of ways. One is because it does leave the soil stripped and unprotected, and the other is that yes, it disrupts the life in the soil in such a way that the carbon that's in the soil gets basically devoured and breathed out into the atmosphere.
The way you describe it, it's almost as though the soil is an organism in itself.
Well, it's certainly a symbiotic net of organisms. They all have to work together. No one of them can thrive on their own.
In healthy, vibrant soil, what happens when, say, a plant needs more phosphorus to repair insect damage?
There's this incredible communication system going on underground where a root will actually signal to the neighboring fungi that it needs more phosphorus, and the fungi will go get it for the root. And in exchange, the fungi get some of the plant sugars.
So getting back to this no-till farming, what are some of the advantages of no-till farming?
Well, it protects the soil in this physical way. You actually leave a big, like, tatami mat on top of the soil so it can't blow away anymore. It can't be washed away by these hard rainstorms. It captures much more rain, which is really critical as droughts get worse, and it protects these microbes that are so critical to plant health.
Do we have to convince the earlier generations of farmers that this might be a better approach? What happened when Justin tried to convince his father, Jerry?
Well, there is some resistance from the older generation of farmers. There, as you say, there's thousands of years of tradition behind this. There's an attachment to these beautiful black furrows that we've all associated with a well-tended farm. So there is a big generational shift. A lot of Justin's generation have gone to agronomy schools and are bringing this new technique home.
If farmers don't till, how do they plant their fields?
They have what are called direct seeders. It's like a kind of a blade, a spinning blade that slices through this mat, this protective mat, and blows a seed down into the soil.
No-till farming has all these benefits, and yet Justin uses Roundup.
Well,
seems counterproductive in many people's minds.
Well, you know, chemicals have been the main thing we've focused on in thinking about sustainable farms, and they're critically important, there's no question. But there are trade-offs to different choices. And so when Justin uses a chemical like Roundup, it's because he has thought through all of the implications of the alternatives and decided that's the most protective for his soil ecology.
Doesn't his approach require you mentioned a machine. How much does that machine cost?
That's a big hurdle. Those machines are several $100,000, and that's a place where federal policy could really help farmers make transitions.
Do you think that Justin's use of pesticides is justified? Because there are many people who see this as a very negative aspect of current farming.
Well, again, Justin starts always with biological solutions to a problem. So he first turns to beneficial pests. He uses cover crops so that these weeds and pests don't come in. He only uses chemicals as sort of a last resort, and he does it because the alternative could be more destructive.
We'll take a little break. When we come back, we'll find out whether organic farming is actually better for the earth. My guest is Miriam Horn, whose latest book is Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, Conservation Heroes of the American Heartland. It is published by Norton. We're back with Miriam Horn, who works at the Environmental Defense Fund and has written a number of books. The one we're discussing, her most recent, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, it's published by Norton. And you challenge many notions that are held by most of us, such as that organic food is by definition better for the earth. You argue that some organic strategies come at high ecological costs.
Well, the organic certification gives you some important information. There's no question that chemicals, we need to be utterly vigilant about how we use chemicals. But it doesn't tell you other things that you need to know. It doesn't tell you anything about whether the soil is being plowed. It doesn't tell you how much carbon is in the soil. It doesn't tell you the health of the microbial ecology underground. And those are all really important questions.
And you say that some organic farmers rely on plastic mulch to control weeds and insects?
That is one strategy. I grew up spending a lot of time on a farm in California with tomato farmers, and they introduced me to this practice that on organic farms where they roll black plastic across the field to prevent weeds from sprouting, and then that plastic, of course, ends up in a landfill.
Couldn't they just use natural organic mulch?
Well, mulch is not really going to going to suppress weeds to the degree that they need them to, and that's why most of them do use plowing to control weeds.
Didn't Whole Foods introduce its own rating system called Responsibly Grown, in which they decided that some produce grown with pesticides got higher ratings than organic produce?
They haven't rolled it out yet. It's in development, and we will be seeing that on their shelves in the next year or two. And they're trying to take account of this broader array of questions, including the carbon in the soil, which Michael Pollan has suggested is really the metric we should now be relying on.
Well, he, in his Netflix series Cook, makes the claim, which you echo, that the Arab Spring was a direct result of a shortage of wheat, which is what Justin grows.
Right. There's no question that the food supply, which is in turn dependent on these farming practices and the stability of our climate, is really fundamental to global stability.
Well, Justin's wheat is sold in Cairo, Egypt, and Lagos, Nigeria. Many of us believe that the best food is the food that is grown within just a couple of hundred miles from us.
Well, I mean, I know you've had Dan Barber on your show, and he's pointed out some of the flaws in thinking overly local about food, that you want an ecosystem to be producing food it's well-suited to produce and not asking every locality to produce microgreens and asparagus.
Or New York to grow oranges or
right, right.
Bananas.
You have to, you know, the beauty of Justin's farm is he doesn't irrigate. He doesn't have to add any water to it. He uses decreasingly less fertilizer because he uses his soybeans and alfalfa to fix nitrogen. So he wants a really self-sufficient system.
Let's talk about one of the other people you profiled, Dusty Crary, who's a third-generation rancher in Montana. And he's become an environmental activist despite his political beliefs. Would he support the Bundys?
No. He's a big critic of the Bundys. He feels like the ranchers that he feels allied with, 99% of ranchers recognize that public land is a benefit that they're enjoying if they're grazing cattle on it, and they are really responsible about taking care of the land and paying their grazing fees. The Bundys are real outliers, and Dusty is extremely upset that they're being held up as representative of Western ranchers.
Dusty, along with a group of environmentalists and like-minded ranchers, drafted the Rocky Mountain Front Heritage Act. What's that?
It's a bill that protected, they live next to Glacier Park and Bob Marshall Wilderness, and first they protected all their big private ranches, which are critical grizzly bear habitat. And then there was this piece of land, a federal land, that was in kind of a limbo, and so they helped write a federal bill to pass it. That's one of the things all of these guys have in common. They are not anti-government. They still see their ability as citizens to shape the American destiny.
And he's also hoping to combat drilling and fracking to preserve the land, but don't many of his neighbors resent his efforts?
It has divided the community, and the argument that Dusty makes, you know, there's a lot of conversation now about trying to keep people safe and economically secure. And what Dusty and his friends recognized is that their long-term economic security depends on protecting those resources, that you drill and you get this boom and then you get a bust, and they want to survive in the long term.
We talked earlier about the Dakota Access Pipeline. What would Dusty's opinion be about the protesters?
You know, I haven't talked to him about that. I mean, he grew up going to the Blackfeet Reservation. He certainly would be respectful of you know, Native American rights to determine the fate of their own land. And he's a real strong private property rights activist, advocate, so I doubt he's very big on eminent domain.
Let's talk about Sandy Nguyen, who was born in Vietnam, the daughter of shrimpers and the founder of a consulting company that helps shrimpers. Who are her clients?
Well, most of the shrimping community in Louisiana are refugees. They're Cambodian and Vietnamese refugees, and they're really on the front lines of all these vulnerabilities, and so that's her constituency.
Vulnerabilities that included being hit by Hurricane Katrina and then the BP Deep Horizon oil spill, one on top of the other.
Right, and then underneath that all, the rapid loss of Louisiana wetlands. Louisiana has lost 2,000 square miles of wetlands, which is where all their shrimp are born, and it's where their villages sit. So the ground is literally dissolving under their feet.
She becomes an accidental environmentalist.
Yeah, you know, Sandy, again, like many of the people I write about, her motivation, she's not a nature lover. Her motivation is to keep her community safe and to keep their businesses viable. But she recognizes that you need these wetlands to protect her community from the hurricanes, and you need them to sustain the shrimp and crab and oyster populations.
What's the master plan?
The master plan is a $50 billion plan, the most ambitious environmental plan in history. It was actually designed by Governor Jindal's administration. One of the most conservative governors in America came up with this ambitious environmental restoration plan, which will release the Mississippi River to again begin rebuilding its own wetlands.
The pledge, which is rather complex, seems to have two solutions, dredging and water diversion.
Well, so both of those are important parts of it. Dredging is using a big machine to suck up mud and build land with it. You can only do a very little bit of land with that. The beauty of using the river as your engine, where you open up gates in the river, is the river carries 1 million tons of mud. It's an engine more powerful than anything humans could ever match. And it's self-sustaining. You don't have to keep rebuilding it. It does all the work.
I also wanted to talk a bit about Wayne Werner, a fisherman. Now, there's been a lot of talk about overfishing, and that's a concern of his.
Overfishing has been a terrible problem, and the species that Wayne focuses on, red snapper, was fished almost into non-existence. It was fished to the point where it almost was never going to be able to rebound.
Wasn't the Magnuson Fishery Conservation and Management Act designed to protect people like Wayne?
Well, it was. It was the first law where people had to actually look at the state of the fisheries and decide how they were going to repair them. It led initially to some misguided regulation that actually made the problem worse. And what Wayne really did was figure out a way to write federal fisheries policy to really restore the fishery. And it's become a model not only around the United States, but all over the world.
So what is the current situation? Are fish stocks returning or?
Red snapper has come back to, it's halfway back to its rebuilding target. Wayne, the approach they use is called a cat share, where they allocate a share of the fishery to each of the fishermen. And Wayne's share has doubled since the cat share was put in place. That's part of the motivation for them to be conservationists.
And Seafood Watch has changed its rating of the Gulf red snapper from avoid to good alternative. But isn't there still a lot of oil in the Gulf? Wouldn't that affect the fish?
Most of the oil that's left is now on the bottom, and it is still moving through the food chain. The worms and everything that are down there are still eating it. The red snapper, they have tested a lot for the oil. There's a group called Gulf Wild that has done a lot of testing, and the red snapper is oil-free, the stuff that's finding it.
And the shrimp as well?
Yeah, the shrimp too. I mean, the local shrimp, buying Gulf shrimp is definitely a better alternative than buying imported shrimp for those concerns.
So is the message of your book that ranchers, farmers, fishermen have to be environmentalists because it's the only way that they can continue doing what they're doing, whatever their politics?
That's a big part of it. It's about this safety and economic security. It's also about love. These are the places that all of their traditions come from. They have generations of heritage. Dusty calls it his homeland. There's a deep strain of patriotism that really runs through it. So it's both economic security and also this sense of love for these great American landscapes.
And also a process of sharing local knowledge.
Yes. Yes, it's a recognition that the people who live and work on the land and have for generations have a great deal to bring to the table.
Miriam Horn's book is Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman. It is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you. My pleasure.